End of fossil fuel insanity and writer for BOE Report and Public Energy number one websites. And boy, a lot going on to our friends to the north. Canada is a good partner with the U.S. when it comes to the oil and gas industry. And we talk a lot about some of the pressures we're dealing with here in this country and federally because of the administration. You deal with some of the same stuff in Canada, right, Terry? I mean, the message coming out of Ottawa is the most positive for the industry as well.
We deal with very much the same things, and if anything, for once, when ironically, when we don't want to be, we're ahead of the U.S. I think with the agenda of our federal politicians, they've subscribed to the fear must trump fossil fuels agenda a long time ago, and they've been working hard to diminish it, the industry, and shift away from it, even though it's futile in Canada, and the ubiquitousness of hydrocarbons is complete, but they don't seem to realize that, and we see that in the U.S. too with some of the policies that are being put in that where the governors think that they can do something about our reliance on fossil fuels in the short term, and it's just not the case, and it's painful to watch them try.
I thought I saw something the other day about one of your female leaders, either from Alberta or Calgary. I don't know if she's a prime minister or what. I'm not sure how the parliament works over there, to be honest with you. But was that in relation to the COP28 new kind of methane regulations that the globe seems to be going under, including the United States? Talk to me about that female that kind of is sticking up for the industry, and is that connected to the COP28?
It predates COP, and the woman you're talking about is Danielle Smith, the premier of Alberta, would be like your state governor, I guess. And in the states, the individual states have certain authority over certain jurisdictions, and the federal have a different set, and sometimes it overlaps or competes. Canada, it's the same thing. The federal government has jurisdiction over certain things, and provincial governments have certain jurisdiction over other things. One of the provincial jurisdictions is the right to resource development, to develop our resources as we see fit. The federal government has kind of clamped down over top of the provinces with their climate legislation, saying we will govern anything to do with climate, which therefore kind of engulfed resource development. So they put out this, for example, what really set the firestorm going predating COP28 was a federal government decree that the grid had to be carbon free by 2035 or something, the electrical grid, meaning they're trying to get natural gas out of the system without carbon sequestration by 2035, or I think some of the standards are even for 2030. It's an impossible task. And the reason that they were able to get away with that politically in Canada is the biggest provinces, population-wise, are Ontario and Quebec, and they have hydroelectric power and nuclear power, and then other western provinces rely heavily on natural gas, as does anywhere else where it's cold. The backbone of the grid is natural gas, and so our premier Danielle Smith has said, kind of over our dead body, will you enforce this on our province? And the neighboring province of Saskatchewan has kind of said the same thing. They said it's ridiculous, and you're just not facing reality. You're just blinded by ideology. So our provincial government is willing to take the federal government to the Supreme Court to challenge these things, and they did win a precedent-setting case there earlier this year against the federal government for overreach into provincial jurisdiction. So it's not a pretty fight. It's a microcosm of what's happening in the U.S., though.
You know, it's that old adage, rules for thee and not for me.
Exactly.
Is what it breaks down to. But you know, the pushback from some of the you know, we deal with this in North Dakota. We're a rural state, the rural region of the country. How in the world do they think by 2030 or 2035 that's a sustainable pathway to go down when those of us that live out in the prairies know that we'll freeze to death if it's not there. We need it. You know, it's kind of like the electric vehicle mandates you're seeing. It's, we all know that, well, they're not up to snuff in the winter. We can't utilize them in the winter in the capacity that we need to travel, provide goods and services, shipping. It just doesn't work right now. And where does this mindset come from? And it's good to see provinces or states like North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska standing up for its populace, its residents.
Right. I think there's a dichotomy that's just growing. I come from a farm, and there are places in the U.S. or in Canada where stuff comes from, where it's made, and people have a certain worldview. And then there are people in the big population centers where they just consume and they don't know where stuff comes from. And frankly, they don't really care. They just want it to show up in the supermarket. They get outraged if there's no bananas in the supermarket, and they have no idea what it takes to get a banana to the supermarket, or wheat or beef or anything, or natural gas. And this gulf just seems to be growing, and people in densely populated urban centers, they look out the window and go, yeah, an electric vehicle works perfectly here because I drive 100 miles every 2 weeks. Absolutely right. Maybe it works for you. It doesn't work for large parts of the country, either your country or our country. And it's but all of the votes are clustered in those population centers. So they're the ones that kind of carry the day on these policies. And then we have this horrible circle of I'm not sure what you call it, but activists / academics that keep pushing these unrealistic ideas and visions. And they're backed by institutions like the International Energy Agency that say, oh yeah, we can go all renewable. It's not a problem. We just have to try harder. And it's like, well, what do you mean try harder? Like, does anybody know what that means? Building endless miles of grid? I think there's a renewable energy agency in the US called the National Renewable Energy Lab. They had a stat a couple of years ago that to go all renewable, the US would have to double their high voltage transmission lines. It's 240,000 miles or something they have to build. And over the past decade, the US has built, I think, a maximum of like 2,000 per year. So it's just an insane suggestion, even. Like, anyone that actually has boots on the ground that builds things says this can't happen. But you have guys in offices that have never set foot on anything concrete like that, industrial, saying, well, not only can it happen, but it must happen by this date. And it's so we have this growing tectonic disruption here where I don't know where this ends, but they have to face reality at some point.
Well, it's my guess, Terry, it doesn't end well, because no. Let's go back to the educational side of stuff. For me, you take a look at that complete lack of understanding in urban centers for farm to market and farm to table. And no, electricity does not come from the switch on the wall. Food does not come from the grocery store. Somebody has to grow that. And that takes traditional energy sources to do just that. We're talking with Terry Edom, author of The End of Fossil Fuel Insanity, Our Friends to the North. Terry's a Canadian and author and speaker. This is Talk of the Town on Super Talk 1270. I'm Steve Bakken, along with Jason Spies from The Crude Life. When we come back, more with Terry on Super Talk 1270.
The Crude Life would like to welcome and invite each and every one of you to the Energy Exposition happening in Las Vegas, Nevada, February 7th and 8th, 2024. Oil, gas, wind, solar, uranium, Bitcoin, sustainable solutions, and much, much more at this year's Energy Exposition happening in Las Vegas, February 7th and 8th. Folks, you don't want to miss the Crude Life Podcast Pool Party happening February 7th. It's the week before the Super Bowl, folks. The Energy Exposition. The Crude Life is all in 2024. For more information, check out energyexposition.com.
You're tuned to Talk of the Town on Super Talk 1270. I'm Steve Bakken, along with Jason Spies from The Crude Life. You can catch Crude Life and The Crude Life in Review Sunday mornings, 10 a.m. right here on Super Talk 1270. We're talking with Terry Edom, author of The End of Fossil Fuel Insanity. He's Canadian, our friends of the North, that work very heavily in the oil and gas industry as well, in conjunction with a lot of that goes on here in North Dakota also. And, Terry, I do have to call you out one little thing. I refuse to say the term fossil fuel anymore. It's traditional energy sources. It truly is. It's traditional energy sources, and that's what we need to be pushing from a narrative.
It, that's true. And technically, it's, they're not even from fossils anyways. Geologists lectured right. after my book. They said, you realize it's technically it's not a term. So, yeah, it, and you're absolutely right. And when I write about it, I call them hydrocarbons, but traditional energy Beautiful. Sources is the best thing. Yep. Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Well, I got a question for you. You know, not only are you a author of The End of the Fossil Fuel Insanity, which is available on Amazon, and is it available in Barnes & Noble? Is that right?
It is. Yep. Go buy a bunch.
Oh. There we are. Are you guys still there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we didn't lose you, did we? Sometimes we try, but. Oh, did we lose Jason there? Okay, he's working on his connection.
Hello, am I here?
Yeah, you're there, Jason.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I'm not sure what happened there, but so and anyway, you also write for the BOE report, and you know sometimes those are two different hats to wear. You gotta wear a reporter hat is totally different than an author hat, and that's why they are actually different. Have you taken a chance to take it a step back and look at what's happening with the energy world in the terms of the carbon and agriculture, how those three industries are starting to really connect more than ever, like through government regulations. Now they're starting to connect and that sort of thing. Have you thought about that ag connection in this whole deal, Terry?
I have, and you're right. And yeah, to take one step back, I'm not even hydrocarbon or fossil fuels, whatever term you want to use. I'm not even a devotee of those. I'm just an energy junkie. I'm just interested in energy, and hydrocarbons get the job done. They have for centuries, and that's not changing. And there's a very strong link between agriculture and hydrocarbons, that one doesn't exist without the other. Modern agriculture doesn't exist without them. And it's built on them, just like our entire civilization is built on oil primarily and natural gas. We can't grow the kind of crops we need these days without oil, natural gas, diesel. It just doesn't happen. And one aspect of it that people aren't that aware of is that fertilizer is critical to providing enough food for today's populations around the world. But we see this primarily in North America, where we're quite advanced here with our farming technologies. And the main component of fertilizer is natural gas into NH3, the ammonia fertilizer, nitrogen and ammonia solution. But the governments are cracking down on emissions everywhere that they see emissions. And so like in Canada here, we've had in 2020, they passed legislation that they wanted to see 30% cut from emissions from fertilizers. And it was a very devious tactic by the government. They said, we're not saying you have to stop using fertilizer, you just have to cut emissions from application of them, which in essence kind of means stop using them. And it goes hand in hand with your statement there about this is an education problem, that people don't recognize where food comes from. And if you want to say you have to cut out fertilizer usage or cut it by 30%, you're going to face a pretty severe decline in yields. And what are the consequences of that going to be? Well, they're going to be much higher food prices. And who's that going to hit the worst is the lower income strata of society. So there's these chain reactions that can happen just through sheer ignorance. And farmers are rebelling. Now farmers are hydrocarbons' best ally, because they're saying, you people don't understand the whole food chain, you urban consumers, where this all comes from. If you think it's all going to come organically from a guy out there growing something on his half an acre organic plot and is going to feed cities, it's not going to happen, even if you have 10 million of them. So modern society is built on cheap energy and relatively cheap food, and there will be hell to pay, sorry, pardon my language, if the price of food keeps going up. And that's what these regulations could very well do.
We're talking with Terry Eadem, and Terry, I want to go back to the education side a little bit, because the agricultural piece, I think, go hand in hand, because people don't understand. If you grow up in an urban setting, you don't understand, for the most part, where food comes from, where energy comes from. It's not that switch in the wall. It's not from the grocery store. Talk a little bit about the educational piece that we're missing out on. How do we connect that urban consumer with that rural producer so that everybody can get on the same page and go, oh, I get it. It's in everyone's best interest that we have food security, because we hear about energy security all the time. Food security right's up there as well.
It is. It's, yeah, they go hand in glove. Fuel and food and shelter are the two or the three primary things that we all need. And I think as I can speak from the hydrocarbon industry, because I'm inside of it, the oil and gas industry, and I've been around for a long time. I know that we've kind of fumbled the ball there on communicating this properly and educating people, not just the youth, but everyone. And we've given opponents a 20-year head start, and we're trying to catch up now. And unfortunately, we've painted ourselves into corners in industry where we seem to be on our back foot saying, oh yes, emissions are bad. Yes, we have to get rid of CO2 emissions. But when we do that, we're just saying we have to stop using hydrocarbons, which is silly. It's just not going to happen, not from a global perspective and not from a North American one either. So we're way behind on the education front, and the industry, the oil and gas industry, has been so vilified now. Well, there's lawsuits everywhere, even in Montana, where young people are suing governments for not stopping the usage of fossil fuels. Where are the people standing up to say, do you understand the benefits of fossil fuels, that it brings you everything you have? And everyone's dwelling on the pollution aspects of it without looking at any of the positive aspects. So there's so much that could be done on the education front to show people how pervasive hydrocarbons are in our life. And then the food chain aspects, where do things come from? How does it work? How skilled are modern farmers at utilizing land efficiently and fertilizer efficiently and fuel efficiently? And even the cattle are getting blamed for emissions, which is, I'm sure that they do have some methane emissions, but people don't understand that cattle utilize marginal farmland. In a lot of instances, you don't pasture cows on your best, most productive land, but you put it on them on rocky land or sandy soil or whatever that doesn't grow crops that well. And there's a lot of efficiencies, and it takes a lot to get the food on the table for hundreds of millions of North Americans. And the onus is on us industries to start doing a better job of explaining that.
We're talking with Terry Edom. You know, it's funny, they go after the cows, but they leave the low-hanging fruit landfills. They have no problem throwing incredible amounts of waste into a landfill, which produces much more methane than a cow. And you mentioned the lawsuits, and it cracks me up a little bit. I call it, and Jason calls it, the Greta Thunberg effect, with these, okay, let's hide behind a high school child or middle schooler, because that'll get the message across even further. And it's pushed.
It's appalling.
These agendas are pushed by somebody decked out in Patagonia or North Face gear because they don't understand where it comes from. There's a huge disconnect on the educational side. When we come back from the break, more with Terry Edom and Jason Spies from The Crude Life. You can catch The Crude Life Sunday mornings, 10 a.m. right here on Super Talk 1270.
The Crude Life would like to welcome and invite each and every one of you to the Energy Exposition happening in Las Vegas, Nevada, February 7th and 8th, 2024. Oil, gas, wind, solar, uranium, Bitcoin, sustainable solutions, and much, much more at this year's Energy Exposition happening in Las Vegas, February 7th and 8th. Folks, you don't want to miss the Crude Life Podcast Pool Party happening February 7th. It's the week before the Super Bowl, folks. The Energy Exposition, The Crude Life, is all in 2024. For more information, check out energyexposition.com.
You're tuned to Talk of the Town on Super Talk 1270. I'm Steve Bogan, along with Jason Spies from The Crude Life. You can catch The Crude Life Sunday mornings, 10 a.m. right here on Super Talk 1270. And we're talking with Terry Edom, author, Canadian author, and works a lot in the hydrocarbon space. And, you know, hydrocarbons, Jason, that entails the agriculture side. It contains the energy side, forestry, all kinds of stuff.
You know, and what's really interesting about one of the things that happens up in Canada is we get Canadian wildfires down here, Steve. And I got to tell you, I wasn't aware until an interview or two that Terry Edom and I did about why we get those. And Terry, talk to us about how this forestry problem has created a wildfire problem due to, I don't know, is it regulations or what's happening with there? I know that the root balls just get left behind. So,
yeah, I think there's a few different pathways that this happens. There's poor forestry management, which I think has been exemplified in California, actually more so than Canada, where there's power lines in contact with brush, and there's people that fight when you try and remove brush or cut down trees. And a lot of the stuff that should get cleaned up, the undergrowth or fallen timber, which is fuel for next year's fires. And so there's forestry management practices which can help mitigate that. And a lot of them are suppressed because for whatever reason. And then there's natural events that have occurred. One of the biggest ones that, and unfortunately people, another education problem, as soon as there's a forest fire, everyone points to climate change and said, oh, there's proof, need to stop burning oil. But there are so many other factors. Again, it's education.
There was then they want to burn trees. I don't get it.
Burn trees. There was a pine beetle infestation, which I know went down into the United States, but it was a huge problem here in Western Canada. This is just one example. This is probably even 10 years ago. And massive, like tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of acres were just infested by these pine beetles, and they killed pine trees. And now there's these endless dead forests that are just like perfect kindling for fire season. And so, but nothing's been done with this wood, and it lacks commercial value because the pine beetles kind of discolored it or something. So, but there's been no strategy to actually get rid of this wood. So now you get a lightning strike and you get this monstrous fire instantly, and you get all the smoke. Sorry about that. But it's a big problem. You see smoke everywhere. And so there's been a lot of forest fire coverage, and in the news, it makes the news, obviously, when the smoke clouds go down to New York City and whatnot and turns it orange. But that's there's a lot of factors involved in how these things come to play. But it's just such a horrible, forest fires are horrible in general, the damage they can do. But then it's become just a messaging tool for people that want to put another nail in hydrocarbons. It's I don't know. It's education is going to solve it, but it's a big hill to climb.
You know, one of the things we've seen in North Dakota too is, you know, we've got some of the cleanest air in the country, and they want to blame our coal-fired power plants for bad air quality. And it's funny because they usually show up, the EPA shows up to test the air quality in North Dakota during a forest fire smoke event that's coming out of Montana or Canada. And then they go, yep, this is the problem. Cool. And they've got jurisdiction because of the Theodore Roosevelt National Park that's in North Dakota. That's their leverage for being able to come in and take air quality samples, forgetting the fact that, by the way, you're upwind from our coal-fired power plants, but that must be the problem.
Yeah. Well, there's no one to defend these things. Who defends coal these days? It's ironically, a lot of the world is building coal-fired power plants. A lot of the world's population, and one of the reasons, even more ironically, is they weren't able to get natural gas. Like countries like Pakistan and China and India, Bangladesh, they're building coal-fired power plants because they were unable to source LNG, liquefied natural gas, because Europe bought it all up last year. So they're desperate for natural gas and they can't get it, so they're building coal, and we're killing ourselves here shutting down coal plants when the rest of the world is building more. But that's part of the media doesn't like to talk about that. So
hey Terry, what's happening up there when I don't know if it's public-private partnerships or if it's, you know, globalism or if it's, you know, the state taking over, but, you know, the marketplace has changed so much and it's getting to the point to where, you know, we're going to have North American regulations very soon before, like, we get these global regulations. So What's happening up there in the world of energy? Are small businesses making it? Are you seeing consolidation like you're seeing in the United States where, you know, I mean, it just seems like there's these mergers and acquisitions happening every week here. I think pretty soon we're going to have Verizon, Chipotle, Exxon as one company.
Idiocracy, man. Idiocracy. Taco Bell won the food wars. We know that's going to happen.
And Carl's Jr. is coming for your kids.
It'll just be a subsidiary of Carl's Jr. It's hard to say. The energy landscape from an investment perspective is so twisted by the amount of money that government is shoveling into things that it's absolutely distorted. And there's a core industry that produces oil and natural gas, and it's doing well mainly because of the shale fields in Canada and the U.S., which account for the lion's share of production now. I think like 70% of U.S. natural gas comes from three fields in Appalachia. One's in Appalachia and two are in Texas. And oil is getting more similarly concentrated in a handful of big fields. And Canada's no different. We're getting concentrated in a few spots. So there's inertia there, and they tend to be in jurisdictions where they will, they're open to allowing their continued existence, like Texas and Alberta and Pennsylvania to some extent. I know that they try and kill it to the extent they can, but they can't. It's a golden goose. So I think the industry as a whole will carry on producing. It's becoming harder to expand. It's harder to build infrastructure. That's becoming evident everywhere in North America. And so that's one of the reasons, or one of the things that's driving mergers and acquisitions, is just it's easier to buy something than it is to build it. To build a new pipeline is becoming impossible, and I'm sure roads are no different, and high voltage power lines, even if you're interested in the renewable side, is becoming more of a challenge. So it's easier to buy something that's existing. I think we're going to pay a price for the regulations at societally here that are being put on that make it more difficult to build things all the time. At the same time, the same groups are urging us to build more of everything at the same time. What I mean by that is that the people that say we can go all renewable and that have the reins in Canada and in the US and are pushing these agendas are saying that we just have to triple our spending on wind and solar, then triple our spending on transmission lines. And at the same time, there's environmental groups who are more the valid environmentalists, if you ask me, who are worried about habitat preservation and endangered species and whatnot, pushing back against some of these developments, saying, hey, you're killing a lot of eagles, or you're wiping out some snake habitat or whatever. And I'm a naturalist myself. I love natural habitat, and I love being out in the forest and the clean spaces. So I think that's worth preserving. And I don't know how those two forces reconcile themselves. They're both in the name of environmentalism, and one has the reins, and they don't really seem to care about the environment at all. They care about CO2 emissions, but they don't really care about the environment. It's quite a misnomer to call the Sierra Club environmentalists, in my opinion.
Some interesting bedfellows. Terry Edom, author, The End of Fossil Fuel Insanity. Terry, once again, as far as your publication, your book, if people want to find that, how do they track that down?
Sure. It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. You'll love it. I wrote it for the energy sector's audience, my audience's audience. I tried to make the energy sector interesting and relatable for people, because people don't care about energy until their bill goes up. They don't care about where gasoline comes from. They don't even know what natural gas is, but they know when their utility bills go up. And you see that everywhere, and it's pervasive. Like, it's boring. I don't want to hear about it. No one cares. No one's grateful to walk into a warm building in winter. They don't go, oh, thank heavens for the natural gas that is keeping me warm. It's just there. It's just something we take for granted, like a sewer, until it doesn't work, and then we're upset, or until it's too expensive. So I tried to take the whole energy story and just break it down for people to say, here's what energy means in your world, and here's what oil means. That if you look around a modern building or home or automobile, it all comes from oil or natural gas or a combination of the two, one way or the other, whether it's through the factory that built it or the process that went into it or the design and testing or the manufacture. It's all based on it. The late, great Charlie Munger, who will be greatly missed, said that if you're talking about the end of oil, you're talking about the end of civilization. And he's not even in the industry, but he had that foresight. That's what he's famous for. And I think that's exactly right. So tries to make that explainable.
Thank you, sir. Terry Edom, some great insight. And maybe we should say thank you when we walk into a warm building. I'm Steve Bakken along this with Jason Spies. This is The Crude Life. You can catch it Sunday mornings on 10 a.m. at Super Talk 1270. This is Talk of the Town. When we come back, our private public picks coming up next.
In a world of ever-changing energy, staying ahead is crucial. We are introducing Oil Man Magazine, your trusted source for leaders in American energy. At Oil Man Magazine, they deliver more than just everyday industry news. They provide a comprehensive overview of the oil and gas market, revealing the trends, technologies, and software applications shaping the future. The Oil Man Magazine honors the proud history of the oil and gas industry by reporting on the cutting-edge developments that drive progress. Dive into fascinating articles about the future of the oil business, pipeline safety, going green, and security concerns. Discover what's happening with oil in America and around the world. The Oil Man Magazine's website is your gateway to the latest news, insights, and breakthroughs in the industry. Everything you need to know about the oil industry is right here in one convenient place. The Oil Man's user-friendly website is packed with helpful information and great features, ensuring you're always up to date. But time is of the essence. The severity of the oil and gas industry demands immediate attention. Now is the time to act. Visit oilmanmagazine.com and empower yourself with the knowledge that drives change. Together, let's shape the future of the oil and gas industry. Oil Man Magazine and their companion magazines, Oil Woman Magazine and Energies Magazine, leading the way for the leaders in American energy. Oil Man Magazine, your compass in a rapidly evolving world.